the more you start to think about all the things we hope to be true about America, the things we all want to believe are true about America, right? That this is, you know, justice is blind, it's reformed but still reforming. We're always trying to work to make sure that nobody, you know, ever goes to prison for a crime they didn't commit, and that our system is there to help them get out if they do, and all of the other, you know, redress of grievances things that we hope for in the First Amendment. But how many people does David Rudolph, the author of American Injustice, Inside Stories from the Underbelly of the Criminal Justice System, how many people does he believe may have been executed who were completely innocent? What percentage of people that actually got the needle or the chair or whatever were actually guilty of the crimes they were accused of? I want to ask him that and how that pertains to the stories that he's worked on, too, on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Talking with David Rudolph, the author of American Injustice, Inside Stories from the Underbelly of the Criminal Justice System. So I floated that question before the break. How many people do you think who have been executed in the United States were actually guilty of the crimes that they were convicted of?
I guess the first question is, are we talking about legally executed, or are we talking about lynchings going back into history? Because if that's what we're talking about, there are hundreds, if not thousands. But let's confine the discussion to people who have been legally, so to speak, put to death by the state. You know, it's a great question, and I think the legal system has fought mightily to keep the answer from ever being known. You know, I'm aware, and we covered this on one of the cases we covered on the Abuse of Power podcast last year, a case out of Tennessee where a family member has been trying to get DNA testing done after an execution to prove that the person, her relative, was not guilty. And the state has fought tooth and nail to keep that DNA evidence from being disclosed successfully so far.
Why? What's the state's argument? What's the state's rationale?
It's a technical argument. It's that the statute that they're seeking the relief under doesn't apply once somebody has already been executed. Of course, in that particular case, the person tried to get the DNA evidence before they were executed, and the state raised a different argument, technical argument. So there is no rationale. You know, the rationale is a technicality under the law, you know, how the statute is worded. But, you know, that's a fig leaf. And obviously what's going on there is that the state does not want anyone to prove that it put to death somebody who was innocent. There's a very good chance there was a person in Texas whose name is escaping me, unfortunately, right now, but who was convicted of killing his children in a fire.
Right. And I remember this story.
Yeah. And there's very good evidence that the expert testimony in that case was completely fabricated.
Right.
And he's probably innocent. But how do you prove a negative, especially when somebody has been killed already? They've been executed.
You address that in the book, too, by talking about how police, it all starts at the scene where police can plant evidence and construct a narrative, which then carries over. One of the cases was headed toward, I mean, he had been convicted. I can't remember which one it was off the top of my head. And I'm sorry, I should have bookmarked it. But where you talk about he had been convicted and because of the circumstances was listed as like a special grievance. And he was the one who found the body and called the police. But the way they rewrote the story somehow, they made it seem like he had done it. Do you know the story I'm talking about?
I think what the story you're talking about is the doctor in Charlotte by the name of
Friedland. Yeah.
That was a classic case of confirmation bias, cognitive bias called confirmation bias, and tunnel vision. And that's a great case of police corruption. So let me talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, from the top. That'd be great.
So Ed Friedland was a very well-respected doctor in Charlotte. He had moved. He was Jewish. He had moved from New York, and that sort of set him apart back in the late 80s and early 90s in Charlotte. There weren't very many of us living in North Carolina at that point. He was married to a woman who was the president of the local chapter of National Organization of Women. They had a very nice life in Charlotte. And one day he came home from working at three different hospitals. He had been at the hospitals from 8 a.m. until 10 p.m. He gets home about 10:20, and he finds his wife absolutely brutally murdered. She's handcuffed with her hands behind her back, multiple stab wounds. Her throat is slashed. I mean, it was horrific scene, just an awful, awful crime. And he calls the police, and the police come, and they don't think that he's sufficiently emotional at what obviously would have been a horrific scene for anybody to view. Put that to one side. They're suspicious of him, but they really don't have any evidence, and he's been at the hospital all day long. So they start their investigation, and they develop evidence against a crack addict who lived just across a busy street from this community where Ed and his wife lived. And he has a history of criminal conduct. They find out that, in fact, he had worked at the Friedland house as a handyman several times. Kim Thomas, the Friedland's wife's best friend, had been suspicious of this guy, and immediately upon the death informed the police that they thought he might have done it. The police find out that this guy is all over the neighborhood the night before she's killed. So he's on the street impersonating a police officer, trying to get somebody to get out of their house, going around to houses looking for money, all over the neighborhood. Then his brother-in-law calls the police and says that he thinks that Marion Gales, this fella, killed that white woman, referring to Kim Thomas. The police have all of this evidence, and then they find out that Ed Friedland had an affair with a nurse and had actually gone to a divorce lawyer to inquire about, divorce law, and had then decided that, no, he wasn't going to do that. Once they find out that he had an affair with a nurse and gone to a divorce lawyer, they completely lose interest in this other fella and focus on Ed Friedland. And what they do is they look inside and out for any evidence. They bring in a blood spatter expert, actually the blood spatter expert who ends up fabricating evidence in the staircase. He's there, and he's talking about how the scene looks staged to him, that someone rifled through drawers, making it seem like there was going to be a burglary, but it really wasn't. It was just
that's so funny. Like, there's an actual. I understand the subjectivity of that, but that's not quantifiable of what the difference is between somebody doing it for real and somebody playing at rifling through a drawer. Well, how could you ever tell?
No, there's no way to distinguish that. But in any event.
It's absurd.
This is where confirmation bias and tunnel vision kicks in, because they have decided that Ed's their guy. And so now you look at a scene, you look at evidence, and you put the interpretation on it that fits with your scenario. That's what confirmation bias does.
Right.
All right. So now they do that, but they go to the DA, and the DA says, listen, you don't have enough to indict. You know, there's just not enough here. And that goes on for 4 years until finally, the police, after going to their local medical examiner, going to the state of North Carolina medical examiner, trying to establish a time of death, because in order for Ed to have killed his wife, the death had to have occurred before he left for the hospital, because his alibi is absolutely foolproof the rest of the day. So they have to establish that she died before 8 a.m. So finally, they go to Michael Bodden, who is a sort of well-known, he was a former medical examiner in New York, and they go to him, and they are asking him whether he can establish that the time of death was prior to 8 a.m. And we get a tape of a phone call that the police mistakenly, they turned it over to a public defender, which, I mean, this just shows you how these cases can unravel in ways that you would never imagine. They turn a tape over to a public defender. It has a 911 call on it. It's a DUI case. And the public defender is listening to this 911 call, and all of a sudden she hears this other detective talking to Michael Bodden about the Kim Thomas murder. And she calls me up and she says, you're not going to believe this, but I've got this tape. So I listened to it. And in fact, you know, what had happened was they reused the tape for a 911 call.
Sure.
But they didn't erase it all. So the first, you know, few minutes are the 911 call, and then it switches into the call between Bodden and the police detective.
Amazing.
And you can hear Bodden saying, you know, I really don't think I can help you with this. It's very hard, blah, 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 blah. And the police officer is saying, well, we really need your help. You know, the only way we're going to convict this guy is by establishing that it's before 8 a.m. And lo and behold, at some point, Bodden writes a report that says, based on the level of potassium in the vitreous humor of this woman's eyes at autopsy, he can say that the time of death was before 8 a.m.
Wow.
And based on that evidence, the DA indicts. But when the DA indicts, the police have withheld from the DA all of the evidence that they had previously gathered about this alternative suspect. So all the DA has is this medical examiner's report, and they don't have any of the evidence about Marion Gales at all. So they indict my client, and we start representing him. They do the perp walk. They arrest him at his office. They take him out of his medical office in handcuffs. All the media is there to film this mysteriously. You know, how did they know this was going to happen?
Yeah.
They film it. And he's put in jail, and he makes bond, and now I'm representing him. I have this phone call, and so we file him, and I call up, there's a medical examiner in Minneapolis who was the person who first discovered that there was some relationship between the level of potassium in a person's eye and time of death. And I call him up. His name is John Coe. And John tells me, listen, yeah, you can tell it, but it's plus or minus 6 hours.
Okay.
You know, I mean,
that won't pinpoint a sunrise.
Exactly. It's plus or minus 6 hours. And John sends me all of the literature, all of the articles that establish that. Then my investigator does what investigators should do. He examines what's called the calls for service in the neighborhood. In other words, who was calling for the police in that neighborhood in the day before? And he finds all these calls for service about Marion Gales. So we subpoena all of the police records from all of the police officers on these calls for service about Marion Gales. And we have a hearing, and the prosecutor is yeah, he doesn't know anything about these things. He says, well, we need to let the judge see this stuff first in camera, you know, without you looking at it.
Right.
I say, fine. They put it all back in front of the judge. The prosecutor walks out about an hour later. He says, you're not going to believe what we're about to show you. And he gives me all of these documents, all of these police reports about Marion Gales that he had never seen. He said, I never saw these. And then we have a hearing on Michael Bodden's testimony, and he knows nothing about any of these studies. He's basing his opinion on a sentence out of a textbook, and you know, basically at the hearing, he said, when I'm questioning about these various studies, he says, well, you know, I don't know how a watch works, but I can tell, I can look at the face of it and tell the time. And so I don't know about all these studies, but I know that you can tell the time of death by the vitreous potassium. Totally inconsistent with all the studies. The judge rules that he cannot testify because it's not valid science. All of those other pieces of evidence against Gales are now disclosed, and the DA dismisses the case. Never goes to try. Now understand that Ed Friedland was facing a death penalty. He was facing a death penalty, and the judge dismisses the case. And I'm sorry, no, the judge.
The prosecutor drops the case. Right.
And the prosecutor drops the case. So is that a victory? You know,
yeah.
does that mean that the system has worked? No. No, Ed Friedland's life was destroyed. His medical practice, his partners kicked him out of the medical practice, and you can understand why. I mean, he's charged with this brutal murder, and even after the charges are dismissed, half of Charlotte thinks he still did it. So he's got to move to another state, restart his medical practice, and it's all because the police decided, based on his affair, that he was the perp, not this other guy. End of the story. The other guy, Marion Gales, a few years later kills another woman and is now in prison for that killing. So,
a murder that could have been very logically, very easy to say, could have been prevented had he been put away for the crime that the doctor was accused of, period.
Should have been, not just could
yeah.
have been, should have been.
Should have been.
So this is a, it's just a, and I apologize for taking that long.
That's what I wanted you to do. No, we're good, David. That's exactly it.
But it's a really important story, and here's why, Ian. It's important because, number one, it explains how wrongful convictions or wrongful prosecutions happen. It's not usually because the police have decided that they're going to frame an innocent person. It's because they've decided that someone is guilty and they don't have the evidence to prove it. And so they're going to create the evidence. You know, they're going to find a medical examiner
sure.
who's willing to say what they need him to say. And
well,
they're going to hide the evidence of the other guy because they're afraid that if they disclose that, well, Friedland's going to get off. You know, his tricky defense lawyer is going to bring all that out in a trial. And this murderer, this New York Jew who murdered his wife,
right,
is going to get off.
Hang there for a second, because, first of all, that's the plot, by the way, of L.A. Confidential, which is very interesting. But also, that is just the perfect way to frame this conversation about American injustice. Other stories from the underbelly next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So we're talking about American injustice, inside stories from the underbelly of the criminal justice system. David Rudolph, famous to most Americans for his work on the Netflix series The Staircase, also has a podcast, but abuse of power is also kind of a theme, right? I mean, he's not just a well-known criminal defense attorney, but also in his own way, he's a civil rights lawyer and kind of an activist, in the sense that he takes on these cases, especially when people who've been accused and or, you know, frankly, railroaded, can't get proper representation, can't get somebody to give them a break. And that's what the, like, if you read these stories, and I guarantee if you like that first story, there's 20 more of them in this book, that go into great granular detail about what police departments will, in this case, the story he just told was about how the police department was fooling the prosecutors to get them to get a conviction by withholding evidence from the prosecutors. Sometimes the prosecutors are in on it. And we'll get to that next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. David Rudolph, I think one of the things that first story that you discussed exposed is that there are obviously a lot of moving parts to our criminal justice system. And we know from TV shows, from police procedurals, you know, from Law and Order, that the first, you know, that show was originally very clearly broken up, that the first half hour of the show was about the investigation, and then the second half of the show was about the prosecution. And then over time, you know, that the formula kind of fell away a little bit. But I always thought that was an interesting way of looking at it. And that is pretty much what we're talking about with American Injustice, that sometimes it's the police that are doing this because they're becoming kind of, you know, curbside jurists. And then sometimes they don't tell the prosecutors, but sometimes the prosecutors know enough or too much, and they still withhold evidence from defense attorneys and or try to game the system because they're too far gone, or there's politics involved, or what other reasons would you say are most common in your experience as a defense attorney?
Well, you know, I think that really what happens is that when the prosecutors get a case from the police, there's this trust that exists where they don't really perform a sort of fail-safe check on what the police have done. And partly it's a question of resources. You know, prosecutors' offices are not generally well-funded. They don't have the manpower, the person power, and the time to really vet the cases the way they should. And so they take what the police hand them, and they go with it. And sometimes, you know, what the police hand them includes exculpatory evidence. And then they suffer from the same sort of confirmation bias or tunnel vision that the police can suffer from. So, again, do I think that most prosecutors are setting out to frame an innocent person? No. I think that for the most part, they think they're prosecuting the right person because they think the police got it right, because they assume that, you know, as most people do, where there's smoke, there's fire. And so they don't want to turn over that exculpatory evidence for one of two reasons, either because the way they look at it, because of their own confirmation bias, they don't really consider that evidence to be exculpatory. You know, they consider it to be false alibis or things that really don't matter. And some defense lawyer is just going to use it to confuse a jury, and it's really not exculpatory. That's sometimes what happens. And other times, it's a more conscious thing where they basically say, no, I'm just not going to turn this over because, you know, this is going to result in this person getting off. And I can't tell you what percentage, you know, each of those scenarios plays out. But that's what happens in cases where prosecutors don't turn over exculpatory evidence. And there are legions and legions of those cases. Every yeah. defense lawyer in America who's ever, you know, handled cases knows that that happens. And it's the great underbelly of the criminal justice system.
Well, okay, so There's, I mean, for maybe it's not a pure fraternity, but I mean, I think there's a, I come from a family of lawyers, and I know that there's sort of this collegial level that exists amongst most attorneys where they try to get along and they try to assume the best. You mentioned it yourself earlier, even last hour, about what the other's intentions are or whatever, and everybody's just trying to do their jobs. But how hard is it for you, and can you give me an example of a time when you were the prosecuting attorney looked you right in the eye and essentially lied, or his office or her office lied, and you later on had to have another conversation with that person, or you have to try to find a way to get along because you're going to see them again in court.
Well, I can go you one further, Ian. I can tell you about an instance, and it's written up in the book, where I was threatened with indictment by a
Okay.
prosecutor who was simply trying to get me off a case that he very much wanted to win. Literally, he sent me and my co-counsel a letter saying that we were being investigated, and this is in federal court. We were being investigated for obstruction of justice, for allegedly disclosing grand jury transcripts to our client, which was completely and totally legal. There was nothing unethical or illegal about it. But he had decided that he was going to threaten us with an indictment for obstructing justice. And at that point in my career, I was a very young lawyer. I was on the faculty of the UNC School of Law. It was 1981, so I had been out of law school for all of 7 years. My career was just sort of starting. And you get this letter, and all of a sudden you are panic-stricken. And I had a very clear understanding of how my clients felt. When they would get these target letters. And so I hired a local defense lawyer. I hired a very well-known defense lawyer in Washington, D.C., Earl Silbert, who had been the U.S. attorney in Washington, D.C., and who had, access to people in the United States Department of Justice in D.C. It was a scary period. Finally, the judge called us into chambers because it was really clear what was going on. I mean, basically, what the prosecutor was saying is, well, you disclosed this to your client. Your client then used this. Our client was the president of the local AFL-CIO in North Carolina. He used it in a union election to try to tar his opponent, who had been a witness in the grand jury. So, he's a witness against you in our obstruction case. You can't represent him because you have a conflict of interest. And that was his whole approach, was to try to conflict us out of the case. And the judge called him on it, and he called us all into chambers one day, and he said, Mr. Prosecutor, we have a trial date set for 2 months from now. I'm not going to disqualify these lawyers. So you have a choice. You can either try Mr. Hobby, the defendant, 2 months from now, or you can indict and try these two lawyers. But you're not going to do both. You're going to choose one or the other. So why don't you get back to me tomorrow and tell me what you're going to do? And my co-counsel and I walked out of that meeting, not feeling really terrific, but the judge knew what he was doing.
Of
And
course.
the next day, the prosecutor came in and said, "Well, we're gonna charge Mr. Hobby. We're gonna try Mr. Hobby. We're not gonna do anything against these lawyers." And so, it's a great example of prosecutorial abuse
Right.
of the system. It didn't work, but it sure scared the hell out of me. and gave me I guess in the long run it was a good experience because I had a real sense of what my clients went through when they got one of those letters themselves.
Right. That's so funny. I don't, this is small potatoes compared to what you just said, but I have to mention it that when I was very young, I went through experience that taught me about police. But, you know, Barry, you know, this is going to sound so silly to even mention it, but when I was about 17 years old, I bought a car. It was all, everything was fine. Got the tags. Everything was whatever. And I was showing my four friends were driving around in this car in this little affluent community that I grew up in. And it was nice though. I mean, it was nice. It was sort of like Mayberry with money. I always described it. A cop pulled me over and he said, everybody get out of the car. Well, I got out of the car. He said, so guys been smoking any dope? Nope. No, officer, we haven't, because none of us were. And then he found some pretense. He was flashing his light on the new tags, the paper temp tags, and said this wasn't sealed. There's no state seal of Illinois on this. This is a forgery. And I said, oh, I just got these tags today. I told him where I got it. I told him whatever. And he said, no, it's a forgery. He said, do you mind if I look in your trunk? And I said, well, yeah. What does that have to do with this? He said, are you telling me that I shouldn't look in your trunk? And he did me the whole roust. And I went to the police chief the next, I mean, this went on for an hour and everybody saw it and they were driving past school and here I was on the curb and there's two police cars and a little bit. Now, again, my problems are pretty minor, but I went to the police chief and down and complained about it the next day. And he said, I could talk to that officer. I could write him up for that. But just remember, if you plan on driving around in this town in that car of yours, he could in turn decide to pull you over at any time and check how thick, how inflated your tires are, or whether you have a deep enough tread. Or he said, so I leave the choice up to you. You can make an official complaint, or you can drive around and not feel worried about this police officer. And I thought, well, that was a message sent and received, you know? And I thought, wow, it's fascinating. And yet later on when I went to college and I met a lot of people who are African-American, and I told them that story once in kind of a, you know, dorm stories kind of thing, they're like, you think that's bad? And I heard things that were 100 times worse than that. And they grew up with that their whole lives. And I just had it that one time. And I think that speaks to a theme, too, in your book about how disadvantaged people of color, people who are economically disadvantaged, they are the ones who are most often the objects of that mistreatment.
Absolutely. And the reason is because most of the interactions between the public and the police are at the local level. You know, we tend to focus in on these national stories. We're concerned about who's going to be elected president or who's going to be elected senator or who's going to be elected governor, when in fact, on a day-to-day basis, what's really important is who's the police chief, or who's the elected sheriff, or who's the elected DA, or who's the elected county commissioner whose commission is going to end up hiring the police chief. Because those are the people who control sort of the quality of life issues that we all deal with on a daily basis. And that's exactly what happens in these communities. You know, if you were black, you wouldn't have even thought about going to the police chief.
Right, probably not.
To complain.
That's probably. And I probably looked like Howdy there. Doody when I walked in there, and I was like, Mr. Chief of Police, I believe. You know, he probably
really
had a good.
I've got to believe that that any black contemporary of yours,
right,
would have thought, my God, you know,
what are you doing?
I would have just been grateful not to have been beaten,
right,
you know, in that encounter. So
yeah,
we both come from a very privileged world, that we can't begin to understand what life is like for those who are underprivileged, poor, minorities, deal with every day on the streets with police and authorities.
Yeah, and I got to point out, in that story that you told at the beginning of the hour, it was interesting that, if I misunderstood, correct me, but that what color was the suspect that the police passed on in order to prosecute the Jewish doctor?
Black.
Okay, so that would seemingly undermine that argument, because here they had a perfect person already. If those are the types of people the police officers are inclined to go after, if you pardon the expression, kind of an easy kill, right? Low hanging fruit. I mean, that's the guy. It was perfect. They can take it off their books and they're done. That would seem usually to be the one that they get tunnel vision over.
Well, and indeed, that's right. But so what's really interesting about the case is that I think there was an element of, this doctor is
Yankee,
sarcastic. He's right. From New York. He thinks he's better than us. He didn't act right at the scene. Ed was the sort of guy who, he had a sort of sense of humor the way mine is, it's his New York sense of humor. You don't take any crap, from anybody. So he wasn't, being super respectful once he realized they were accusing him. Once there was the affair, everything turned. It was because from a police officer's perspective, the husband is almost always the prime suspect in a spousal killing. And then you couple that with an affair and his trip to the divorce lawyer, and boom, there it is.
Right.
He killed her for money. He didn't want to pay alimony.
Right. And so there you are hitting a couple of things that Yankee, New York, Jewish, affluent doctor, somebody who wasn't in their circle, and maybe they focused on him because of that prurient interest or that type of, that's it. And he's a cheater. And he cheated on his wife. And so it was to teach all cheaters a lesson, or that somehow the cheating spouse is what's the low-hanging fruit, not somebody who's prowling around the neighborhood. But it's interesting how that kind of stands in contrast a little bit with some of the assumptions. But then again, it also speaks to how complicated American injustice is. Inside stories from the underbelly of the criminal justice system. David Rudolph is our guest. I want to do this, David. I want to open up the phones coming up, because I know there's a lot of people who've been wanting to get through and they want to talk about this. But I still want the same way that you've been relating the book to maybe what these questions are. So if somebody asks something and there's something in particular in the book that you think is relevant, I think that would be a good way to connect that. I think we all enjoy learning through narrative like that. And you've got so many, tragically fascinating stories in the book, American Justice. In the 10, 15 seconds that I have here, what's been the response to you from other prosecutors, or from police that you know, for this book? How do they feel about it? And I only have like about 30 seconds.
I don't know the answer to that. I'm hoping that they will invite me to come and speak to them and debate about it, because I think discussion about this is important. And hopefully I can get to at least some detectives who are willing to listen. So that's what I hope, but time will tell.
All right. There's so much work to be done. It is what was described in that HBO doc. Change is the slow hustle. a lot of work to be done. But fortunately, the groundwork is being done by David Rudolph. Some very interesting stories to start with coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.